As we resume our study tonight, we're going to take up with the first return and say some more about that. I'm going to erase some of this, but before I erase it, I want you to look again that the first return was led by Zerubbabel, also called Sheshbazzar, and Jeshua, the high priest. And this first return was in 536. And the description of the events of this return are told in Ezra chapters 1 through 6. Now we're going to look at a sort of a little chronology here so that you can see some things. We're going to be looking at Haggai and Zechariah briefly as well. Okay, so Cyrus was the emperor who gave the decree that the people were allowed to go home. And so they went home. That was about 536, as we pointed out. The very next year, they began to build the temple. And they laid the foundation. As soon as their neighbors learned that they were building that temple, the neighbors said, "Hey, we want to get in on that." Let me put a map up here for just a moment. And I want to show you more particularly where these neighbors were from. These were the neighbors up here in Samaria and in this area to the north. And here were the Jews down here in Jerusalem. So these neighbors from the north, and you notice that this is just one of the satrapies, one of the satraps, rather, of Persia by now. This is not Israel up here. This is just one of the provinces of Persia. Well, these neighbors came and wanted to help build the temple. And the Jews said, "No, you can't do that. You have no part in this." Because these were the pagans from way off somewhere that the Assyrians had brought in there when Israel was taken away in 721. And the Bible says that, yes, they worshiped Jehovah, but they worshiped the other gods as well. So they were just idolaters with an idolatrous outlook. And when they were turned down and not allowed to build the temple, then they decided they were going to impede the progress of the Jews, and they just did all manner of things to stop them from being able to build the temple. When Cyrus died in 530, he was followed by his son Cambyses. Now I want you to observe the dates here for a reason. Cambyses is the one that ruled between Cyrus and Darius. So here Darius takes over about 522, and he will rule until 486. Now when you read in Ezra 1 through 6, you will find that Cambyses is not mentioned by name. But when you look in chapters 3 and 4, you will find him referred to as Ahasuerus and as Artaxerxes. And since we have proof positive in Ezra that Darius was the king under whom the building was resumed, then look, it was stopped under Cyrus, resumed under Darius. That meant there was only one king in between who could have been that Ahasuerus or Artaxerxes. So they wrote to Cambyses, the son of Cyrus, and said the Jews were rebuilding Jerusalem, that very troublesome city. And when he checked and found out that was so, then he sent a decree stopping the work. Now, the sad thing about this is the Jews were glad to have an excuse to stop the work. Do you know why they were glad to have an excuse to stop the work? Because there were other things they wanted to do with their time. You know, that sounds rather modern, does it not? You know, we can say, "Hey, let's cut down on the religious stuff so that we'll have more time to do the fun stuff." So the Jews were glad to get their excuse not to work on the temple anymore. They said, "Well, the king won't let us." So they went merrily on about their business. And some years went by, and in 520, there were two prophets that God raised up. So this is, you see, before the death of Cambyses. So these two prophets were Haggai and Zechariah. And I would ask you now to turn to the book of Haggai in your Bible, if you will, and let's notice some very poignant and very pointed lessons in the book of Haggai. You can look at it. It's not a very long book, but I'm going to summarize very quickly what the messages of Haggai were. The messages, the visions of God to the prophet Haggai came within 3 months. All of it came within 3 months. And the message came and said, all right, here's Haggai talking to the people. He says, have things turned out the way you expected them to turn out on your return? You came back looking for much, and you've gotten little. Do you know why that is? Do you know why it is that you sow a lot, but you don't reap much? And you have some to drink, but you don't have enough. You have some to eat, but you don't have enough. You're still hungry. And do you know why you bring your wages home and put them in a sack with a hole in the bottom of it? Do you know why that is? It is because you have not built my house as you were supposed to do. So both Haggai and Zechariah stirred the people by this message. Haggai also said, now you say, well, we haven't had the time to do it. You've had time to build your own houses. And you've done more than just get a roof over your head. You have sealed the inside of your house. In other words, you've done a real nice job on your own houses, but you haven't done any kind of job on the house of the Lord. Then Haggai had another message. Now earlier, I mentioned the fact that when they first laid the foundation back here, up here in about 535, just after they came back, when they first laid that foundation, remember I told you this morning that there was a lot of shouting for joy, but there were also old men there who had seen the first house, and those men wept. Well, both Haggai and Zechariah point out that when you look at this foundation, when you look at this house that we're building now, don't let it discourage you. Don't think, oh, this house is going to be nothing. Do not despise the day of small beginnings is the way that Zechariah pointed it out. And now then, let's look at that book of Haggai for just a moment. And I want to show you a couple of points from the lessons that Haggai teaches in it. In the second chapter of Haggai, look at it. Verse 2, this is addressed to Zerubbabel, to Jeshua, and to the remnant of the people. Now listen to verse 3. Who is left among you that saw this house in its former glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes as nothing? Now, do all of you observe that most definitely was the attitude on the part of a lot of the people? They were thinking, oh, this house is just not at all like that, the Solomonic temple. Why, this will never amount to anything. And Haggai says, no, you've got to look beyond just this physical building here. The house that the Lord is going to build, why, it's going to be more glorious than the other one was. And as he goes on, look in verse 6 with me. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once, it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the precious things of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. And listen to this, the latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former. Obviously, the Lord is not speaking through Haggai of the physical temple that was being built here at this time. But he was wanting these people to see that this was just the beginning, that God's plan was on target, that His plan had not broken and fallen to the ground, but His plan was still on target. And what was going on right here at this time in Jerusalem was a part of a greater plan that God had. And so God was trying to cheer them to believe that. Then there was another very important message that Haggai brought following. He said, now, you need to understand that everything you have done until now has been affected by your failure to rebuild my house, so that nothing you did was for good. Nothing worked. But now that you have started on this and you are rebuilding the house, from this day forward, I will bless you. Now that's a very pointed, but a very powerful, a very simple lesson. The way we live has to do with the quality of our lives spiritually. And the blessings of God cannot be expected, especially the spiritual blessings of God cannot be expected if we do not live and serve God. And then the last message of Haggai is a repetition of the idea of God. I will shake the heavens and the earth. I don't know why, but in my mind, I have always pictured a board, just a flat board here. And if I took that board and took dominoes and dabbed just a little super glue on the bottom of each domino and then stuck it there and held it until it was fixed. And I did that with a whole bunch of them, but there was one domino that I put and just stood up without putting glue on it. And then I held this board like this with all the dominoes on it, and I ask you, can you tell which domino has the glue? Well, no. But what could I do and show you immediately which domino does not, or really, more appropriately, I don't glue any of them but that one. Let's do it that way. I don't glue any of them but that one. And now, which one has the glue? Which one cannot be moved? I just shake it. And all the dominoes fall down except the one which cannot be shaken. And that's the point God is making in this prophecy. That I'm going to shake the heavens and the earth, and I am going to reveal the kingdom that cannot be shaken. So, you see how Haggai got the people going, showing them there was a connection between their failures and the lack of blessings that they were being given. They were shown that they could not possibly be pleasing to God unless they moved ahead with the program. They were shown that God still had a plan, and that plan was on target, and that plan would lead to a house that would be far more glorious than the Solomonic temple ever was. Now then, if you would, turn to Zechariah. Zechariah, the very next book. Zechariah is a rich and powerful message, because the message of Zechariah has to do with the spiritual house that God had His eye upon in the future. Not just this house here immediately before them, inferior physically to the Solomonic temple, but God had His eye on that spiritual house. Bringing the Jews back, in a way, was a resumption of God's plan. It was almost like that. It was like almost a resumption of God's plan. And so He says, look, this is just the beginning. Don't get hung up on this house. Look to the future. And Zechariah works to help them see that future. In chapter 2 of Zechariah, look at verses 4 and 5. Run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as villages without walls by reason of the multitude of men and cattle therein. For I, saith the Lord, will be unto her a wall of fire round about, and I will be the glory in the midst of her. Look in verses 10 and 11. And many nations shall join themselves to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people. And I will dwell in the midst of thee, and thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto thee. And the Lord shall inherit Judah as his portion in the holy land, and shall yet choose Jerusalem. Be silent, all flesh, before the Lord, for he is waked up out of his holy habitation. In these verses, we find the idea of nations coming and being a part of this. We find a Jerusalem that is expanded far beyond the old Jerusalem. And this is the emphasis throughout the book of Zechariah. Look at chapter 4. Chapter 4, verses 9 and 10. The hands of Zerubbabel. Key in on that now. The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hand shall also finish it, and thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto you. For who hath despised the day of small beginnings? Or who hath despised the day of small things? And so Zechariah is helping them to see that point. That don't think that this foundation that you see here, that's the end of God's plan. No, God has a far greater plan than that. Chapter 8. This is a beautiful chapter. If we can get our minds in spiritual tune and read these chapters, they are the most beautiful, appealing chapters you can read in the Bible, and it pictures something that is a wonderful situation. The Lord speaks of Himself. I am jealous for Zion. In other words, I'm going to look after my people. Look in verse 4. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, there shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, every man with his staff in his hand for very age. And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, if it be marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in those days, should it also be marvelous in mine eyes? In other words, if you think, oh, I don't see how in the world you can do that. I don't see how that... If you look at it that way, does that mean that I should look at it that way? God said. Isn't that a pretty powerful message? The things that we see as difficult, the things that we see as, oh, I don't see how that can... With God, all things are possible. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country, and I will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and righteousness. And that whole chapter is just a beautiful chapter describing the spiritual future that awaits God's people. So we won't take the time to study the whole thing. The last great message of Zechariah, chapters 12 through 14, set forth the indestructible nature of the new spiritual Judah and Jerusalem that God is going to make. Well, these two prophets stood up and got the people going again, and they began to work, and that house came along, but then the governor heard about it, Tatnai, and he came and he said, what are you doing here? They said, well, we're building this house. And Cyrus gave us permission to build this house. So Tatnai said, well, let me get the names of the men involved here. And he wrote the names of the leaders and the other men involved. And then he wrote a letter to, but by this time it was Darius on the throne. He wrote a letter to Darius. And he said to Darius, when I came to Jerusalem and I found the men there working. And boy, they were really working. They're working hard. The thing is really coming along. And when I asked them about it, they said that Cyrus had decreed that they build this house. Will you check into that? Well, when Darius did check into it, he found that indeed his great predecessor, Cyrus, had given that decree. And here it had just languished and nothing had been done. So Darius sent word back immediately. He said, all opposition of this building is to cease. This building is to be completed forthwith, with all haste. And the expenses are to be borne out of the king's treasury. And so, whereas there were obstacles before, suddenly, boom, all the obstacles were gone. And so it was that by 516, the house was finished. But now, look at the math here. The Jews returned in 536. It had been 20 years. 20 years. But from 536 down to 520, all they had done during that time was lay the foundation and then quit and did not try to do any more. So that essentially they built the temple in 4 years. It really didn't take them that long. Well, this was the first return. It would be 58 years from that date, from 516. It would be 58 years when Ezra returned, that would be the second return of the Jews. But there was something that happened before that. Something that happened before that. We'll leave the Persian kings listed up here. This Darius, as I pointed out, ruled from 522 to 486. And he was a great Persian king. When he died, his place was taken by a man, his son, named Xerxes. And Xerxes ruled from 486 to 465. Now when Xerxes took over, the Greeks had shamed his father in a battle. So it was his intent to get revenge on the Greeks for what they did to his father. So he built up all of his kingdom for a major battle with the Greeks. And in the third year of his reign, he had a tremendous feast that lasted for 6 months. And nobles and generals and important people were there from all of the 127 provinces that extended from India all the way over to Asia Minor. And he displayed his wealth before them all. Then they had another feast for 7 days. And in that feast, everybody in Shushan could get in on it and take part in it. And the king's heart was merry with wine. And he decided, oh, this would be a good time to show everybody the beauty and the glory of my royal wife. So he commanded that she be brought in. Vashti. So his chamberlains went over to Vashti and they said, the king says you are to come and appear before him and his guests. She said, no. That is a word that Persian monarchs never got to hear. And he was not used to hearing that word. And she said, what? What am I going to do? And he called his advisors in. Now, these were his counselors. He said, what am I going to do about this? They said, O king, this is a serious matter. Because as soon as the wives throughout the empire hear what Vashti, your wife, has done, why, there won't be any husband in the empire that has any control over his wife. So what we advise is that you write a decree and you send this decree out and let everybody know that, first of all, you are putting Vashti away and she will no longer be your queen. And when people see that you have made that decree, then all the wives throughout the kingdom will see that, oh, they're not going to be able to get away with disobeying their husbands. And if we don't do this, pandemonium is going to be the result. So Ahasuerus thought, well, that's a good plan. So he did that. Put Vashti away. And after doing that, he went away to war and just got annihilated by the Greeks. So that instead of getting revenge for his father, his own army wound up being cut to mincemeat before it was over. And he came back depressed and unhappy. It was 4 years later, and he got thinking about Vashti. And his counselors observed him, and they said, something's got to be done. So they said, O king, we have a suggestion to make. Why don't you go throughout the kingdom and get all of the beautiful young women that can be found and bring them together and choose yourself a new queen from amongst them. And Ahasuerus thought, yeah, that sounds good. Let's do that. So they gathered the beautiful young maidens from all throughout the kingdom, and one of these maidens was named Hadassah. That was her Hebrew name. Her Persian name was Esther. And she had a cousin named Mordecai who was old enough to be her daddy. And he had taken care of her and reared her from a child. And when she was chosen as one of the young maidens, she was put in the hands of Hegai, the keeper of the women in training and everything. They would undergo a whole year's training and conditioning and all of that kind of thing. And so during that time, Mordecai had warned her, don't tell anybody you are a Jew or a Jewess. So she went through this training and she won the complete favor of Hegai. And he gave her the very best place in the women's apartments and gave her 7 attendants. And the way it would work, the young woman would go into the king, Ahasuerus, and after that, she was counted as one of his wives. In other words, then she left one house, and after that, she lived in another house, in another place, in the harem, as one of the king's wives. When it came time for Esther to go in before the king, the keeper said, well, what would you like? She said, I'm going to take what you recommend. So he told her what he recommended, and she wore that and went in before the king. And the king was so taken with her, so pleased with her, that he made her the queen instead of Vashti. So everything was going great. This was the 7th year of Xerxes or Ahasuerus. And some years went on by, and during the time that these years were going by, Mordecai sat in the gate, kind of like a courtroom of the old cities there, and one day he overheard 2 men talking, Bigthan and Teresh. They were the keepers of the king's bedchamber. And they were plotting to kill the king. And Mordecai brought that to the attention of the authorities, and it was found to be so, and they were taken and put to death, and the king's life was saved. More time went along, and there was a man in the kingdom whom Ahasuerus advanced. His name was Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. And oh boy, he was lifted up and made the most powerful, noble, the most powerful man in the kingdom under the king himself. And so Haman, he was so proud of his fame and everything. And he would go out through the city and everybody would bow and just fall down before him. But there was a fellow that wouldn't bow down to him. And that man's name was Mordecai. He would not bow down to him. And Mordecai's associates brought this to Haman's attention. And Haman then began to watch. And he saw him. And he said, who is that fellow? He learned Mordecai. He learned he was a Jew. He said, I'll fix him. So Haman went to the king and he said, O king, there's a people in this kingdom that are just a lot of trouble. And if you will give me permission to do so, I will get rid of them for you. I'll even foot the bill for you. The king said, no, there's no need to do that. Here, take my ring and make the decree, whatever you want to do, and don't worry about the footing the bill. That'll be all right. King really trusted Haman. So Haman and his confederates cast lots and chose the month in which they were going to do this. They chose the 12th month, the month of Adar. That's the month we're going to do it. So they put decrees throughout Shushan and throughout the empire saying that on this certain day, all the Jews were to be killed and all their possessions taken. As soon as Mordecai saw that decree, he was horrified. And he took off his regular clothes and put on clothes of mourning, sackcloth and ashes. And he came down to the street outside the harem building where Esther was. And it wasn't long before some of the people said, hey, Esther, Mordecai's outside. And he's just got rags on. Esther didn't know a thing about what's the matter. So she sent a servant out to find out what's going on and take him some clothes. So here the servant comes out bringing these nice clothes to Mordecai as if clothes is what Mordecai's problem is. Here Esther said to wear these clothes and Mordecai says, forget the clothes. Look, we've got a problem. Look at this decree. You take this and have it read to Esther and tell her something has got to be done. So the eunuch took it back in and it was read to Esther. And essentially what Mordecai was saying, you're going to have to intercede with the king. Esther said, I can't just walk in anytime I want. If you walk in to the king when he has not summoned you, he may just put you to death. And he hasn't called me for over 30 days. Mordecai sent word back in. The servant was shuttling back and forth. And Mordecai said, let me tell you something. Don't think that you will escape. If the destruction comes, don't think you will escape just because you're in the king's house. And if you don't stand up and help us, then there will be somebody else. But it may be that you have come to the kingdom just for such a time as this. And when Esther got that word, she said, very well. But I want you to tell everybody to fast. The idea was, they should pray. And she said, I will fast and I will pray and I will go into the king and we will see what happens. So when all was ready, Esther went in before Ahasuerus and she came in over at the side of the throne room and there Ahasuerus was on the throne and he looked over there and he saw Esther. Whew, he smiled. He held his scepter out to her. And that was the sign of favor. So she came up to him and he said, Esther, what do you want? You tell me what you want and I will give it to you up to the half of my kingdom. She said, well, what I would like is for you and Haman to come to a dinner that I have prepared. That's easy enough. So Ahasuerus and Haman come to the dinner that Esther fixes. And there they are eating together. And Ahasuerus says, now Esther, what is it that you want? If you will tell me, I will give it to you up to the half of my kingdom. She says, if you will come to a feast that I make tomorrow, then I will tell you what it is I want. When the feast was over, Haman went out and he was just floating up in the clouds because I got to eat with the king and his queen, just the three of us. I am really somebody. But then he went out, and there was that old Mordecai again. and it just stole all of his glory. And you can almost see Haman just stomping home. And when he gets home, he gathers all of his family together and all of his servants, and he brags to them all about how great he is and how he has eaten with the king and the queen, and he's supposed to do it again. And then he says, but that's not worth a thing in the world to me. This Mordecai continues to plague me. And they said, well, why don't you build a gallows? Why don't you just build a... What it would be a platform with a pole, and Mordecai would be hanged from that pole. Why don't you build that gallows? If I remember, it's like about 75 feet high. And hang Mordecai on that. And Haman said, oh, that is a wonderful idea. I'm going to go to the king next morning, tomorrow morning, just as early as I can get there, to ask him if I can do that. Well, that very night, the king could not sleep. So he called for the royal records to be brought in and read to him. And so, as the servants opened the royal records to read, these records were written in a very interesting style, so that it was entertaining to hear them read. And it just happened that the scribe opened it, and he began, and he said, in the year so-and-so, there was a Jew by the name of Mordecai who overheard a plot that had been laid against the king by Bigthan and Teresh, and he brought it to the attention of the authorities and saved the king's life. And old Ahasuerus was saying, was anything ever done to reward this man for what he did for the king? And the scribe said, no, O king, there was nothing done to reward. Well, what a horrible oversight. That won't do. What can I do? Well, the king scarcely ever had any ideas of his own. So he said, is there anybody out in the court? Yes. Haman is out there, waiting to come in and ask if he can hang Mordecai. But nobody knew what Haman was there for. So they said, yes, Haman is. And so Ahasuerus said, oh, good, good, have him come in. So Haman comes in. And as he comes up to the king says, Haman, I want to ask your advice. What should the king do to the man that the king wants to honor? And of course, in Haman's little mind, he immediately thought, it's me. I'm the one. So he began to tell the king what he would like done for him. He said, well, O king, I would dress that man in one of your royal robes, and I would put that man on one of the royal horses that you yourself have ridden, and I would get one of the greatest nobles of the kingdom to lead his horse through the city and proclaim to all the city, this is the man that the king delights to honor. Well, that really appealed to Ahasuerus. He said, very good, Haman. You take Mordecai the Jew, and you do this as you have spoken. If you can imagine the struggle of Haman to keep his face from manifesting his shock and dismay, and he has to go and get the clothing and get the royal horse and go get Mordecai. And if you can imagine the expression on Mordecai's face, and then here Haman leads him through the city with the whole city knowing what's going on. And when it was over, Haman was just, he was mortified. And he went home covering his face. He went home and he told them, oh, woe is me. And about that time, the message came saying, Haman, remember your appointment with the king and with Esther? It's time for the little tete-a-tete that you were going to have with them. But his family had already said, uh-oh, if you have run afoul of Mordecai the Jew, then I'm afraid it's all over for you. And with those words of encouragement ringing in his ear, he went off to his little meeting a whole lot more nervous than he was the day before. He got there and the meal started and everything was going pretty well. And Ahasuerus was very relaxed, very big-spirited here. So he said to Esther again, well, Esther, now what is it that you want? You just tell me, and I'll give it to you up to half the kingdom. He was thinking, well, O king, what I'd like is this real big, beautiful ring with a big ruby in it, or what I would like is this big sedan chair to carry me about, and something like that. And instead, she just launched into this very passionate, emotional, save my life, spare my life, O king, spare my life and the life of my people. And you know, this is just a terrible shock to Ahasuerus because he's saying, I didn't know you were in danger. Who's trying to kill you? She said, "That wicked Haman." Well, then the king was so angry, he got up, he couldn't even speak. And he just walked off out in the garden out there. And Haman is left here, oh me, what am I going to do? And he said, the only possible thing I can do is throw myself on the mercy of the queen. So he just threw himself down there at the couch where she was lying to plead with her. And the king came back in and said, "What are you doing?" And Haman did not even venture to say what he was doing. They came in, the servants came in, and they could see which way the wind was blowing, so they just covered Haman's head. And while Ahasuerus was standing there, "What am I going to do with this man?" They said, "Well, he built a gallows to hang Mordecai on." King said, "That's a very good thing. Hang him on the gallows he built to hang Mordecai upon." And so this story illustrates the providence and the power of God to intervene. And we see these people like Esther and Mordecai, who move along with circumstances being brought together by God that result in the salvation of His people and in their deliverance. And this story occurs. It begins to occur. Esther actually begins to come along in the story about 479. Now, I'm not going to tell quite the rest of the story, but that's the gist of it. The Jews won because God gave them deliverance. When Xerxes died, his place was taken by a man whose name was Artaxerxes Longimanus, and he ruled from 465 to 425. Now, you know, the only thing really important to us about this man, he is mentioned in the Bible, not by Longimanus, but by Artaxerxes. He is the man who ruled the Persian Empire during both the return of Ezra and also when Nehemiah came back. In fact, Nehemiah was the cupbearer to this very man. In 458, approximately only 7 years after this Artaxerxes began his reign, in 458, Ezra came back. And he came back with around 3,000 or 4,000 Jews. And Ezra's concern and his concentration was to purify the religion, to purify the way the people were serving God, to seek to draw them nearer to God, and also to straighten out certain things that were wrong, like marriages to pagans and things like that. So he worked very hard to do that. And let me go ahead and just put Ezra right here. And that was 458. And then Nehemiah came along also. And Nehemiah came in the 20th year of Artaxerxes. That's where we get the date 445 for him, because if Artaxerxes began in 465 and Nehemiah came in the 20th year of his reign, then that's where we get the date 445 for Nehemiah. And Nehemiah spent at least 12 years of his life working with the rebuilding of the city and also Nehemiah did not work just on the rebuilding of Jerusalem. He was also as devoted as Ezra was to seeing that the people served God and were faithful as they should be. And he did everything he could to ensure that. And he gave his life, he gave his resources, he prayed fervently. He's one of the most praying men the Bible tells us about. He prayed to God and depended upon God, and he helped the Jews, and they rose up and rebuilt the walls. And remember that the decree to rebuild the city of Jerusalem was included in the decree of Cyrus, as we read this morning from Isaiah 44 and Isaiah 45. So Nehemiah succeeded in motivating the people and gathering them together and doing the work, and they got the walls of the city of Jerusalem rebuilt. And in the 7th month, they gathered together when they had the walls built. In the 7th month, they gathered together. They observed the Feast of Tabernacles. They went out and they cut boughs. They made booths. And they observed the Feast of Tabernacles as it had not been observed since the days of Joshua. That is a remarkable fact, isn't it? that they observed the Feast of Tabernacles as it had not been observed since the days of Joshua. And then they had a reading of the law. As Moses had commanded, the law was to be read, and the law was read at the Feast of Tabernacles here. They had a public confession of sins. The leaders of the people signed a covenant that they would keep the law of Moses, and they would honor that law. They all signed it. And then they dedicated the walls. It was a time of rejoicing. But now, would you turn to the book of Malachi? Unfortunately, the Jews did not use the opportunities that they were given as they should. When you take the 12 years or so that are mentioned in the book as time that went by for Nehemiah, that would bring us down to the year 433 or 432. And that's the date given for the prophet Malachi. So, Ezra and Nehemiah were contemporary with one another. Nehemiah and Malachi were contemporary with one another. Probably all three of these men overlapped somewhat and were contemporary with one another. But now then, look at this book of Malachi. Malachi is the epitaph to the Old Testament. You know what an epitaph is? An epitaph is the writing on a tombstone. And so I'm saying that here at the end of the Old Testament, we look at Old Testament Israel. And what Old Testament Israel was called upon to do by God, what they set out to do, it was a failure. On the part of Israel, it was a failure. In other words, they, the people, had not measured up. This didn't mean the plan of God was thwarted. It didn't mean His plan was stopped. But it means that physical Israel had failed to measure up to the challenge that God had posed before them at Mount Sinai in Exodus 19 when He said, "You shall be a holy nation," and they hadn't done it. And Malachi points that out. Particularly, I'd like you to read with me chapter 2 at the last of chapter 2. "You have wearied the Lord with your words, yet you say, 'How have we wearied Him?' In that you say, 'Everyone that doeth evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and He delighteth in them.'" Or, notice this question, "Where is the God of justice?" Now here were people who themselves were being wicked and didn't recognize that they were being wicked. And they were quick to point the finger at everybody else. Look at how terrible they are. Look at how terrible they are. When the Jews themselves were being wicked. And as if, "Oh, we are so good, and we just deplore all these evil people around here, and we just wish God would come and wipe out all the evil people." And what Malachi is wanting them to understand is, well, when God does come, you say, "Where is the God of justice?" Well, when the God of justice does come, you will find you will not be able to stand before Him. Look in chapter 3, because that's where he carries the thought on. "Behold," see, look at the questions. "Where is the God of justice? Behold, I send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me." The messenger is John the Baptist. The "me" there is God, as He would come in Jesus Christ. "And the Lord whom ye seek," that is according to your words, "the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to His temple, and the messenger of the covenant whom you desire, behold, He cometh. But who can abide the day of His coming, and who shall stand when He appeareth? For He is like a refiner's fire, and like fuller's soap," that's bleach, "which will get the stain out. And He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and He will purify the sons of Levi." In other words, when the Lord comes, He's going to come in a way that you don't know. And when He comes, He will come to do things you haven't expected Him to do. He will judge men. Interesting thing is, that Jesus said while he was upon the earth during his mission. He said, I did not come to the earth to condemn men, but to save men. But that was true of his earthly mission while he was here. Overall, the mission of the Messiah and the work of the Messiah would involve both the salvation that he came to bring men and the judging that he would do as the judge over all, in which place God would place him. And that's what Malachi is telling about here. It's 400 years. It's a little over 400 years before the Lord's coming. But Malachi here, inspired by the Spirit of God, says, yes, he's coming. The very one you've asked for is coming. But when he comes, who will be able to stand before him? The last passage, Malachi 4, verses 4 and 5. I mean, verses 5 and 6. Malachi 4, verses 5 and 6. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of the Lord come, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. So Malachi closes that Old Testament period, the last of the prophets, and